Enjoy food the way nature intended. Alaska Seafood, wild, natural, and sustainable. For more information, visit wildalaskaseafood.com.
Hi, I'm HRN's Executive Director, Katie Mosman-Wadler, with a preview of this week's episode of Meat and Three, our weekly food news roundup. This week's theme is youth. We'll have a report on how migrant children separated from their families at the U.S. border are being housed and fed.
Right now, what we're very worried about is just the influx of kids created by this zero tolerance policy.
We'll also look into a program that's ensuring free summer meals for kids are only a text message away.
Summer is the hungriest time of year for a kid who may not have that safety net of school meals.
We discover a new home economics curriculum.
I'm not trying to raise a generation of chefs. I'm trying to raise a generation of nourishers who can nourish themselves.
And we meet a teen chef who's talked his way into several of New York's top kitchens.
I never try and be, like, annoying about it, but I really want to get my foot in the door.
Tune in to this week's episode of Meat and Three, available at heritageradionetwork.org and wherever you get your podcasts.
If you heard the noise they make, but let me introduce my new Rocket 88.
Yeah. All right, we are back on a new edition of the Main Course OG, which we think about changing to the Main Course OMG, but right now it's still the Main Course OG. I'm in studio with Elizabeth Greeley, Mike Edison, Brandon Hoy. I'm Patrick Martins, and our special guest today is Anthony Butler, the former executive director of Bread and Life, the largest hunger relief organization in Brooklyn, and an HRM board member. You just heard Rocket 88, which is arguably the first rock and roll song ever recorded. It was the first sound ever to be played in these studios at Roberta's Pizza in Bushwick, Brooklyn. And the Main Course is actually the first show ever to be on. So first rock and roll song of all time. First radio show of all time about food. So
when we started in 1939,
just when radio technology was being invented. So without further ado, we have a very fast-paced show every single week. It's the second fastest show on radio after Mike's show, Arts and Seizures. Libby, take us through.
Sure. We have a great show lined up for you today. And we have topics from mac and cheese to Oprah's newest investment and world population. So we're coming in a lot here. We are always excited on hearing what the myeloid reaction question is, and we end with the weekly grill segment talking with Tony Butler. So we will jump right into our topics where our panelists do not know the exact details of the questions and see how they do. So Slow Foods is having their annual conference in Denver this weekend. HRN is attending and recording. So what is the state of Slow Foods in the USA today, and what does Slow Food mean to all of you?
All right, well, I'll start that as the co-founder of Slow Food here in the U.S. I work with Carl Petrini. I mean, this is my biggest thing. Slow Food is now a bona fide lowercase word. When we started in 1998, you had to capitalize Slow Food. And then if you did write Slow Food, you'd have to write a comma after it and explain. An organization that believes in respecting regional cuisines. And now you just say Slow Food. It's a opposite of fast food. People know it. So I think Slow Food has really, given us a gift for all the ages. I think Carlos should win a Nobel Prize. Now, in terms of the organization itself, that's another matter. I think, you know, one thing Italy doesn't have, which it's Slow Food, which America does, is committees. And committees destroy great ideas. So I really hope that whoever is the leader of Slow Food here really says F you to all the other people who are trying to slow them down, and they just launch projects because committees kill great ideas, and I think they've suffered from that a little bit. Too many chefs in the kitchen.
Agreed. Slow food as an idea is a great concept, but I think as a lot of these things trail on and get aged, they start to kind of have their ideals compromised somewhat, and you have to be careful that you're not stifling the creativity of what it meant to be slow foods. I think in the early days, and I think we're kind of starting to see that it's more of a word you put in front of something to sell something else, like organic.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I agree. When it started, I think the idea was, and what you taught me and what I learned from Carlo, the original idea was you don't talk about things, just do them. It was very action-based. You know, it's always easier to beg forgiveness than it is to ask for permission kind of attitude, full steam ahead. And that's the way things get done. When it does get bogged down in committee, things do get slowed down. You know, you have five people trying to design an elephant, and what do you end up with?
Yeah, now it's called slower slow food.
Yeah, but you don't hear it as much as you used to, though, slow food. I don't think I hear it the way I used to, the way it was a thing. And I don't know if people understand as much as, like, when the original slow food book came out, what exactly is slow food? People don't understand that the slow part happens before you take the food home.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, eco-gastronomy. Well, that was Mike Edison. Before that was Brandon Hoy. Tony Butler, our guest, do you have anything?
Yeah, I just wish the slow food movement would continue to evolve to the other side of the table. Because I still find restaurants, particularly here in this country, are so transactional that I haven't finished something and somebody's asking me for what I want the next. I mean, I think the slow food movement did a great job and continues to reduce that kind of transactional in the preparation. It's not just, it's where it's sourced from, how it's prepared, and all that. But I find, from a customer standpoint, that many of our restaurants are still very just transactional.
And people at home, too, right? Eating fast.
Eating in front of the television.
Yeah. Yeah. I think slow food is also, yes, a lifestyle. And we got too frenetic. We confused frenzy with efficiency with fastness, you know, and sometimes the snail actually might be the most efficient.
Excuse me,
animal.
I'm the slowest walker, Patrick, and you are always making fun of me for that. So I'm interpreting it in my own way in my life. That's slow true, eating, right. Slow walking.
Well, let me whip a little zen on you. Sometimes you got to go a lot slower to get to where you want to be a lot faster.
Well, that's funny. You know, Carlo's old line was, we all end up in the same place anyway, so let's get there slowly.
That's the grave.
Yeah, dirt in the mouth. Yeah. That's a happy ending.
Oh, gosh. Haven't we lightened the room today?
So slow food will kill you.
Slow food will kill you.
All right, well, now we're moving on to mac and cheese, which is a much less morbid topic. So there's nothing like a good bowl of mac and cheese. Maybe that's why it's the number one most Googled recipe on the internet. What's the best mac and cheese ever? And what do you have to say about mac and cheese?
Mike has mac and cheese right with him right now.
I think a bowl is like a small-minded way of thinking things. I like my mac and cheese fried on a popsicle stick.
Oh.
Very nice. I like all the crust. They should make a very thin mac and cheese with no inside, just that top layer of burnt. And more things should be burnt. French fries should be burnt. Mac and cheese, grilled cheese sandwich. Not really burnt, but just that little black.
I always ask like my fries, well done. Like classic diner order when you go in and say, you know, I want my burger medium rare and I want my French fries well done.
By the way, the people not burning stuff and keeping things in the oven long enough speaks to what Tony just said. Too fast. I want to eat. And then they also burn their mouth because they're not waiting long enough. It's like eating a meal should be take time.
My biggest problem with mac and cheese. Burning your mouth.
Oh yeah,
I'm not really a huge mac and cheese person, to be honest with
They're
you.
They're kind of gross.
It's kind of like kids' food in my mind.
It's also American.
I love its Americanness, but it's never been something that I've been.
The big no is truffle oil. I don't see any truffle oil anywhere near, but truffle oil mac and cheese, because it's got nothing to do with truffles.
Now, depending,
it's just a bunch of perfumed garbage.
Depending on how many bong loads Mike Edison has taken, Kraft mac and cheese would probably suit him well at some point. Maybe a little sriracha.
But you're right. Truffle oil, terrible. It is.
Like, you can just in general. I don't want to see it anywhere ever. French fries, truffle oil, French fries. Like, no, I will walk out of your restaurant if I see that on the menu. It just shows that you have no respect for me or your own food.
Yeah. Truffle oil, because, you know, if you put a truffle in oil, that oil will never acquire the taste of the truffle or the smell of it. It has to be infused with,
it's got nothing
big
to do with truffles. Yeah. It's as much to do with truffles as, like, you know, Dr. Pepper has to do with natural flavor.
Doctors.
Yeah, doctors.
Yeah, that was better.
That was a good one. All right,
we'll fix
what's
that in
next?
Post, all right, Dave?
Got it.
All right. From CNBC, Amazon's purchase of Whole Foods flipped the meal kit industry upside down. Celebrity spokesmodels, football stars help sell vegan dinners. We keep coming back to this meal kit. Celebrities like New England Patriots quarterback Tom Brady and supermodel Chrissy Teigen are drawing new clients with branded kits and recipes. Amazon hasn't even begun offering meals to its more than 100 million Prime members, and its reputation for disrupting entire industries already has the meal kit market changing up its business model. And meal kit companies are partnering with supermarkets, drugstore chains, and introducing a variety of specialty diets to try to lure and retain its customers.
I'll tell you what, I'm looking for a meal kit designed by Dennis Rodman, the worm. And you guys know where I'm going with this, right? Dig around. Get me something good, Dennis Rodman. I'm sure he's got a meal kit up his sleeve that's going to blow all of our minds.
Maybe some Korean barbecue.
Korean barbecue. Well, you are putting Dennis. Thanks for bringing up Dennis Rodman yet again.
Is Tom Brady still a thing?
Yes.
TB12, baby.
<Yeah. laughs> Well, deflate my meal kit.
Well, that really, the hell with Amazon. Amazon is I cannot stand
I thought Mike
Amazon.
Edison was asleep this whole time, and then look at that.
He comes out with genius. I cannot. Amazon is a symbol of a lazy country, I think, and also probably in other places in the country, like small towns or falling apart, you know, you don't have your town squares, your little centers. So maybe Amazon is very important, but it should always be a last resort.
The other day I got my groceries delivered to my car.
While you were driving, the guy pulled up next to you?
Yeah, just loaded it right into the back.
We do bring up meal kits because, Tony, we didn't bring it up. For the past two episodes, we have been covering meal kits. Mm-hmm. First of all, and my wife hates meal kits. She hates them. She thinks they're ridiculous.
It's bullshit.
But the New York Times now sells meal kits, and that doesn't seem fair. They advertise it in their food section. It doesn't seem correct that the New York Times would sell meal kits. Maybe they're not writing about companies like David Chang's meal kit company or Heritage Foods because they're selling it. They take out full-page ads. Do they pay the full price? And then when we did research, they had no information on the provenance of their meat and all that. So I don't know. This whole meal kit thing says lazy to me, and Amazon says lazy to me, and relying on Tom Brady for what you should eat for dinner instead of cooking at home says lazy.
You should have a pantry. I mean, that's what the basic thing is. You should have stuff at your house. I talked to a friend of mine who does get these meal kits. And I'm like, well, you know, sometimes I don't have everything. Well, okay, so maybe you don't have enough sage at your house. Sage costs 79 cents. It's available everywhere. You live in Brooklyn, you go to the corner, they have sage. It's not a problem, especially if you're planning, you know, to make dinner. You go out, you buy the ingredients. But a normal adult family, a normal adult person should have stuff in their pantry to make dinner from. You shouldn't have to go out. Oh, it comes with, like, you know, a pre-measured tablespoon of salt. I mean, are you fucking kidding me?
Yeah, it's ridiculous. I think these things were originated for people on far corners of the world, not necessarily urbanites living in densely populated areas where you could literally walk four blocks and get everything you need. There are people that live in places that it can be difficult for them to get everything they need, and I think it's for them. But why are you taking cooking advice from a football player? Like, what does this guy have? What does Chrissy Teigen have to offer me? Is there, like, a credential?
Did she conceive anything in that kit?
Yeah. Like, why is her meal better than, like, can't you just buy a cookbook from somebody who's obviously been cooking for the majority of their life or made it a profession?
Yeah.
Get a cookbook and buy things and have them in your house.
Absolutely.
A pantry. I mean, listen, I live in New York City for one basic reason. I can get an avocado at 4 a.m. You know, really, it's not a problem. I realize that's not the rest of the world, but now this meal kit thing is just the convenience factor, and convenience sucks. Convenience always sucks. You always sacrifice quality for convenience.
And it also comes at a high cost. What are we doing with all the stuff that's packaged in? Mm-hmm. Every meal is an Amazon or whomever delivery. That's a huge, times millions and millions a day of these kits.
Yes. Well, that gets us into our next story, Tony. Exactly.
Exactly. We found on average, this is from Forbes, it is almost 5 times more expensive to order delivery from a restaurant than it is to cook at home. And if you're using a meal kit service as a shortcut to a home-cooked meal, it's a little bit more affordable, but still almost 3 times as expensive as cooking from scratch. So not only costly money-wise, but also in all the different packaging. Yeah. Yeah, no, definitely.
Well, we were looking last week at, I think it was like steak dinner for two, and it didn't tell you what kind of steak you were getting.
Yeah.
And the price was like $20-something. I'm like, how do you even buy steak for two people for that much money? So therefore, I already know it's going to be crappy, you know, commodity farmed meat. It's terrible. Plus, of course, I'm paying a premium for what, the salt and the pepper? That's all it is. You can't go to a store and buy a couple of steaks. I mean, that's how simple.
I hope it's a Salisbury steak.
Yeah, right.
Or chicken a la king.
Yeah, some shit
nuggets.
On a shingle. I get it on some level, if it's some complex thing, you know, I used to buy like chili kits, you know, when I was first getting into it, because it came with a lot of different spices and was part of, you know, somebody's secret thing. Or if you're making cassoulet and there are a lot of different ingredients and you want to sort of buy it in one fell swoop.
It's another vessel.
Buy a couple steaks.
It's another vessel for like individual marketing to take, like to market yourself as a, like, it gives Tom Brady and all of these people another opportunity to market themselves as a fully rounded figure who knows about everything. Tom Brady must know about everything. I should take Tom Brady's advice. Tom
Brady, accounting.
Like, what kind of nail clipper does Tom Brady use? Because I'm sure it's amazing. His toes must look beautiful.
I bet these were designed, though, with a target market and like maybe just like the single male who doesn't know how to cook. Like, who do you think it was originally designed for?
I don't see that's at the target market. At all.
People in Alaska.
I think people working. I think it was upper middle class, paycheck to paycheck, who want the illusion that they're cooking and being chefs. Mm-hmm. And they get this that Tom Brady taught. I think that's real. It's not, because it's not a financially sensible decision.
Yeah,
is it like
true.
The TV dinner, a descendant of the TV dinner,
yes,
kind of in the 50s?
It might be some of that, yeah.
It's the descendant of the TV dinner, but then also you get to tell your friends that you cook like Tom Brady.
True. So you get that.
I'm the greatest of all time. My cook arm, like Tom Brady.
My arm just got stronger.
I just threw four dinner touchdowns.
Well, I think it's also it makes it easier. The one person who buys these things says, it's great because I don't have to think. I know on Monday I'm having this and Tuesday I'm having that. Yeah. And
idiocracy. Yeah. So ultimately,
so really
we're getting into a world where thinking is.
He's had five meals, but the pantry, but he's not building a pantry too, which is the other point I make. This whole time he's buying stuff, he's not buying staples, you know? So at the end of the week, what do you have? You have nothing. You have a bunch of empty boxes, and your house is empty.
I would like to say two things before we go to the end of the planet thing. First of all, I always say this. I always look for
Morbid.
The quickest solution. Yeah. Eat pasta, spaghetti. It costs $1. It takes 10 minutes, and it's so easy to make.
And you can have it in your cabinet in the kitchen. Yeah. You don't have to have a kitchen that, like, you might as well get rid of all your cabinets.
Yeah.
Just
exactly.
You know, use it as another TV room for
spaghetti,
your Xbox.
Spaghetti.
Oh,
that's
my God.
The whole
secret. People send out for a meal kit for pasta. I mean, if you and any day of the week, you know, and any day of the year, you could walk into my house and there are probably, you know, seven different shapes of pasta to start with. There's cans of good Italian ported tomatoes, and there are a million things you can do.
That's the easiest meal in the world.
You know, we have onions, we have garlic, we have a million things you can work. I got fresh squid ink in my house if you want to go down
but,
that
but
route.
Before we
I
move,
have possibilities.
Before we move off this, how many times do you do a meal kit before you know how to cook? Like, how, like, at what point are you like, okay, I figured, like, now I've seen these things and I know what's in it, I could just go buy, I don't, I could just go
save.
Buy some onions and shit and have it in my...
I think it's a good transition to learning how to cook, maybe.
Well, there's also this point, too, that you made about ordering out food. This is not the meal kit, but just to order out from your, you know, your local Chinese place or Thai place or whatever the popular takeout food is, it's very expensive.
Yeah.
It comes in, it's like $20 a portion or $20.
But I love ordering in Chinese food. Apparently, I heard it gets there very quickly because they actually cook it on their bicycle. The pedals actually power a small oven in the basket. That's how
thing.
It comes. I literally hang up the phone and my bell is ringing.
But I tend not to order out because I'm invariably disappointed. I spend $45 for two people to eat a bunch of bad food that I could make for $4 myself.
Well, you can't make Chinese food.
Actually, yeah, I got to walk. I mean, and I have the ingredients. I've got some garlic, some ginger. I've got various spices. No, I can't cook.
You can't make
Do you know General Cho?
I was going to say, do I know General Cho?
Because I think that's the secret to General Cho is like you actually have to know General Cho.
Certain things you do need to order in, and I do think people should spend money, but it needs to be sometimes you order in. Sometimes you can do
I order
a meal
occasionally,
kit,
but most of the
cook.
Time, every time I'm there looking at the seamless, I'm like, what did I just fall off the turnip truck? That's going to cost $50 for bad food.
And particularly getting stuff that I know I can cook.
Yeah.
I mean, I want to go get something that I can't cook.
Right.
Yeah.
Right,
somebody
right,
knows
right.
better than me.
Exactly. Yeah. Not yeah. like a piece of fish.
No, I mean, and restaurants are great for certain things that are like high, you know, labor intensive. I mean, restaurants are great at making French fries because they're really messy and it's a pain in the ass to make French fries. It's why I don't make French fries at home, because it's messy and it's labor intensive. And no, I don't make General Tso's chicken, certainly not as poorly, which is kind of what you want actually when you're ordering it out. But if I was making some fried rice or a stir fry or vegetables, I'm certainly quite capable of doing that.
Also, the modern
with fresh ingredients at like an eighth of the price.
The modern day restaurant is more about the experience too. I mean, obviously the food is number one, but you're going out to eat because you're a person who likes to go out. Yeah. And you can, there's only a number of things to do when you go out. So is eating important to you? Do you like eating? That's why you go out. You're not like, Mike, I just need to get something in my belly.
Yeah. I'm wasting away.
Let's go out to eat.
That's a different question though, because restaurants, I drop a lot of coin in restaurants. I like people bring me food. I like the ambiance. I like the experience. Listen, again, the other reason I live in New York besides the 4 a.m. avocado, it's really the only reason to live here is to spend money, and it's to spend money in restaurants, and it's to spend money in concerts and in things that I don't have access to if I were living somewhere in the Midwest. I live here to spend money. That's what this place exists for and little else. And I love coming to a restaurant, and I love dropping a little bit of money on the wine list, and I like feeling a little bit special, making
and
it a date,
and
to spend 3 hours over dinner. As long as I'm getting value and not getting feel like I'm getting ripped off, I don't mind spending a lot of money in a restaurant.
All right.
All right, and then I will
But that's
say,
a lot different than ordering out food, because no matter what, if I feel ripped off, I won't do it again.
Can I do a personal plug for Heritage Foods? I do think that... Uh-oh, my mic fell off. I do think that Heritage Foods is a mail-order company, but we sell meats that are impossible to find anywhere else, like very, very rare breeds. So there's a place for everything, but... Chrissy Teigen, and that's how you're eating with your kids 5 days a week, and then McDonald's the rest. I mean, Mike was telling me about his brother who, like, uses McDonald's as a great job. You did well in gymnastics, so now we're going to go eat a quarter pounder with cheese. Like, that's crazy.
Yeah, you did great in your athletics program, so now I'm going to poison you.
Yeah. No, for sure.
All right, tell us about our next lighthearted story.
So I was reading Orion Magazine and was reminded that yesterday was the United Nations World Population Day. Will we be able to continue as a species given all the things that we have done to this planet and our home?
No.
It's a tough question.
I have two people to blame about the world population going out of control. One is me,
because
I'm having three kids, and the other is Tony and his church, because they argue against birth control.
Interesting argument, though, in the New Yorker 3-4 weeks ago. You could fit the if you had the density of Manhattan, you could fit the entire world's population in Texas. So the overpopulation is a bit of a myth. It's the distribution is issue. The biggest issue is what we're doing to the planet. It's not because people are being conscientious about the planet. We have so many people just minimally polluting. We have the United States consuming 75% of the world's resources and having about 20% of the population. I don't think the issue is about babies. The issue is about greed.
Yeah.
Okay. And I think that's where it falls in.
Interesting. Wow.
Also, there's got to be plenty more planets we could fuck up. Let's just figure out how to get there and start fucking wrecking havoc all over the universe.
I think Dennis Rodman's working on it.
I know. It can't be too far away. Light years, right?
He's going to be the leader of Space Force.
There's definitely a bunch of old DeLoreans sitting around, like, waiting to be converted here.
Actually, we've already started.
Time travel's got to help.
Outer space is a disaster. There's like a litter belt.
Whoa. I've seen
There's actually like a belt of like junk circling the Earth right now. That, it would make New Jersey blush.
A cosmic antique show.
I would say, though, Tony's right, though. Why don't some people just move to, like, Wyoming or, like, the Rockies?
Because then I couldn't blow my money in Roberta's.
Oh, I see.
It's
I could get an avocado at 4 a.m.
Chinese
food, it sucks.
So wait, let
and
me
such
ask.
Small portions.
It's not birth control? I mean, shouldn't the Pope embrace some, like, the condom in India or places like that? Or no, you don't have an issue with that?
Well, the issue is that says that I'm more valuable than the next person, and I don't know
but
if
that unborn person you
right
are
but
more
still
valuable.
But we still need, I mean, all of Europe has a negative birth rate. We have a negative birth rate, and it's going to get worse with our immigration policies, because the only reason, particularly in this city, we don't have a negative birth rate is because of immigration. And they're the larger families, particularly Hispanic families tend to run larger. So we could do birth control, and then we'll all be 70 years old with about $10 in our pocket, because no one's putting into Social Security, no one's running the restaurants here, no one's being the busboys, no one's slaughtering the the heritage beef, all those kind of things, you need the next generation. It's very short-sighted to say, well, it's all fucked up, let's stop and try to fix it. You can't do that.
Tony's so smart, that bothers me.
You just gotta stop dumb people from having babies. There's gotta be some sort of like litmus, a star rating where you're just like, you only have 2 stars, that means you only get a half a kid, sorry.
You gotta earn your stars if you wanna have a baby.
You need a license to go fishing in most places.
right. You need a license to drive. Yeah, you could just like be 10 and have a kid.
Well, actually, this is interesting that in China, how they had the one-child policy, and now there's a lot more men, and there's all this issues, and like the housing crisis, and that I like reading about that's very interesting.
Besides, the bathroom lines are horrible in China. Have you been? It's like you almost have to go to the women's bathroom. Good thing they I think they already have adopted the transgender bathroom, so I think everyone's free to that one.
That's very interesting.
Wait till we find out General Cho was a woman.
Uh-oh.
Trans woman.
All right. So, yeah, we have to take
from
care of the planet.
From trans women to?
Oprah.
To Oprah.
So from Eater, Oprah added a restaurant to her investment portfolio. True Food Kitchen announced that the queen of all media made a significant equity investment in the health food restaurant chain. The idea was to promote Dr. Wheel's anti-inflammatory lifestyle with a restaurant.
You win a chicken grilled breast. You win.
George Foreman grilled for everybody.
Oprah doesn't need a restaurant, okay? She doesn't look like she's missing any meals. I think she's her anti-inflammatory food thing. Listen,
nobody
these people
shaming.
That come on her show, they're charlatans, they're hacks, they're snake oil salesmen, you know, they're the worst. Dr. Phil, Dr. Oz. These people, what are they doctors of?
I don't trust her.
Sorry, I just don't trust her. I don't trust her brand. You know, I think she's
a good person, but she's basically getting into
how
the
do
meal.
You know
kit.
That? Do you know this?
Why she gave you Dr. Phil and Dr.
Do you know how many people she's put her hand on their knee? That's very nice. People do that.
Oh man,
dude, most people get like.
I choose Phil Donahue.
Oh,
now,
he
if
was
Phil
mean.
Donahue opened a steakhouse. I would be in there. I'd be like Phil Donahue Steakhouse. This has got to be good.
A man you can trust.
It's got to smell like tingy, like a weird odor in there.
Okay, but I do believe in the anti-inflammatory diet. Both my sister and my mother are on it right now for arthritis. And
how about the anti-inflammatory radio show?
Where you get less swollen every time you listen?
We're trying.
So wait a second. Does anyone have an issue with Oprah getting into the food? She got into meat once. She talked about meat, and then the Texas ranchers sued her. And then she never talked about food for years and years and years and years.
The danger with Oprah is when she gets into anything, it's so powerful.
Yes.
And any of these kind of not so scientifically documented, but people suffer from them. It's like gluten intolerance.
Mm-hmm.
Really, people, it's a very small percentage of the country have celiac. Very small. But everything's gluten-free because somebody got on that bandwagon and some marketing. The danger is when Oprah has an anti-inflammatory restaurant that can say that all other restaurants you shouldn't eat there because they're not doing it. And that's the danger. That's the Dr. Oz kind of thing. When he says something, you know.
That's very interesting.
It might be an informed opinion.
Tony, this is the last time you're on this show. I hate looking. You always have the most interesting thing to say.
I think also like part of this is like some. Didn't she like lose a bunch of money with Weight Watcher? Didn't she take control of Weight Watchers? And I believe it failed, the Oprah experiment on Weight Watchers. And now all of a sudden she's like, oh, I'm going to go out and do my own thing. I don't know. It smells a little bit like if Weight Watchers wasn't in my way, I would have dominated this field. And maybe I should just do this on my own. I don't know. To me, it kind of smells like that's her take on it. And she's a very smart woman, and she probably is right. There's probably a lot of people that were standing in her way there. And she probably felt she would be more successful doing it on her own. And I think maybe this is her attempt.
Again, the best foods, if you really were sick, tabbouleh, hummus, baba ganoush, pasta. Boom. You eat those, kibbeh, falafel. You could eat that 7 days a week and you will be healthy 100%. You know, it's like that's
Patrick
an answer.
Martin's.
But it's not selling anything. That's the problem.
That's your meal kit right there. You should just put it together, like put your face on it. And
I'll tell you, there's not one Middle Eastern chain. Pairs,
different types of plastic we could wrap it in, and we'll start shipping it out.
I'm going to start selling matzo balls to the Goyim in Ohio.
Name a national chain that's Middle Eastern. The most successful cuisine in the world. The one that the food pyramid is based off of. It doesn't exist.
Mouse.
What?
M-A-O-Z, Mouse.
Well, no one's heard of it. But yeah, I mean, but it is. And then New York has some, you know, there's, I forget the names of them, but you know, there's some great Middle Eastern restaurants in New York. But I'll tell you, Sam Edwards got bit by a tick and he couldn't eat meat for 2 years. And I took him to Ilili, this Middle Eastern restaurant in New York. And he was like, this is the best cuisine I've ever had. And I'm like, you're 60 years old and you've never had Middle Eastern? He's like, well, I live in Virginia. I'm like, there's not one. It's just interesting. Yeah, I'm surprised.
Amazing. I mean, I eat at a Middle Eastern restaurant probably 3 times a week.
Around it's the best corner food from in the world.
Yeah. Nice and Muslim guys will let you bring your own wine, so it's
a great place. There we go. All right. This is an interesting article from New York Post and from Cranes. Follow that food cart. The city health department wants to add location tracking devices to mobile food carts in order to facilitate inspections. Inspectors do not regularly check one-fifth of New York's 5,500 licensed food trucks because they cannot find them. Critics say such devices would create potential immigration status conflicts for some vendors.
I don't believe that.
How can they not find a food truck? I can find a food truck.
Do you microchip your kids?
No, but I mean, listen, they need to be inspected. And if there's illegal aliens, you know, in those trucks or driving those trucks or working for those trucks, so then they still need to be inspected. Yeah, I don't care.
But I don't think you need tracking devices. I think it's a slackers of the inspectors.
Why? How do they find them? What if they're driving around? They have to run? This isn't like delivering to Brandon's car.
But trucks know where they... You know, trucks don't move around. They have to be at a set site because the customers won't know where they are. You always go to the X truck on Wednesday or whatever because you know it's there. Well, inspect them there. Or inspect them in the warehouses where they're kept.
Well, that's possible.
Food carts.
Yeah,
and food carts. But they know... Yeah. They're all controlled by like 2 or 3 companies.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I'll tell you what, though. On the other end, on the trucks... you know, and like it's probably not a bad idea. Like, you might as well use that technology for yourself and show your customers where you are at all times as well.
Oh, true.
So, that's I don't know. Point. I think if they force your hand in this, like, hey, let's be real, it's probably best for everybody if these trucks are getting, you
inspected,
know, inspected.
Sure.
Like, right. You know, this is maybe the worst problem with these is they go just, you know, uninspected. But also, it's like if they're going to force you to use this technology, use it to your advantage. Like, let it be known that this is where you are. Go to our app. Find us anywhere you want. You know, you could go to our app and you could see where you could find a truck.
That's like food health. You know, when the USDA came out with HACCP plans, everyone was like, why do I have to write everything down? But it was ended up being the right thing. It should have been embraced from day one. And if they need these places to be inspected, so yeah. I don't care.
Yeah,
if
there's the illegal alien. ICE, that would actually, now that I think about how it really jeopardize, even if you are undocumented, you're going to be out there working. I mean, if ICE wanted to, here, I'll arrest you and have a hot dog kind of thing, you know. But because it's just a GPS system. It's not giving any information. It's just locating.
Yeah, checking.
Yeah. All right.
All right. Well, that was a great session today, and we're going to go to a quick break. Take it away, Vitor.
That was slow.
I'm not Vitor.
Oh, David.
David, HRN engineer.
This is the story of men and women who shed not only their clothes, but also their...
Think about what it takes to swim a coastline longer than the entire eastern seaboard and leap tall waterfalls in a single bound. What does it take to survive 200 feet deep in icy salt water? What would you be made of? Wild Alaska Seafood is made of tight muscle mass, long chain omega-3s, and incredible micronutrients. It matters where your food comes from. Experience the flavor of the fittest in every bite and enjoy food the way nature intended. Alaska Seafood, wild, natural, and sustainable. Ask for Alaska on the menu, grocery store, or smart device. For more information, visit wildalaskaseafood.com.
Hi, I'm Moxie Rosenblum. My dad, Harry Rosenblum, hosts Feast Your Ears on Heritage Radio Network. Right now, HRN is having a summer membership drive. Becoming a member is so easy, and you'll help support shows like my dad's. You can sign up for a one-time donation or become a monthly sustaining member by visiting heritageradionetwork.org/donate. Let's keep food radio on the airwaves this summer.
I'm worried. Are we getting child abuse laws? Are we violating any child abuse laws for that? That's pretty crazy.
I'll have to check with legal on that.
All right. So you're listening to the Main Course OG here on the Heritage Radio Network in Roberta's in Bushwick, Brooklyn. And we are now on the Maillard reaction, which is everyone's favorite part, right?
Of course. I love it that it's two silent L's right in the middle.
So we just launched our new Heritage Foods website, and we are so excited. I've lost so much sleep over this, but it's now live and ready to go. So what is everyone's here favorite website? Is it the look of it? Is it usage? Where do you shop the most?
Interesting.
What do I shop?
It's definitely not shopping. My favorite website is I read the New York Times every day, and I read CNN because then I get shut out of the New York Times after three free articles, and ESPN. ESPN, New York Times, CNN. That's it. Those are the only three I ever look at.
And that's where you get your news. That's why you're so well informed.
What do you think I should use? New York Times and CNN, that's not good enough for you?
I do opposition research. I always read the Times and the New York Post to know what both sides are thinking. I try to read as much right-wing, hate-based media as possible just so I know what the other side is thinking.
I do it, too. I do the same thing. I'm, all over Fox just being like, what are these guys saying? What are they saying?
After I read the New York Times and, that liberal slant of the Huffington Post, I go immediately to Fox News to know what the actual country is thinking.
Right.
Well, 30% of it anyway. So, Brandon, what's you?
I don't know. Actually, that the kind of I've never even thought of a website as something that I'm like or dislike. I mean, obviously, when you're using one, you're like, this works, this is great. But there's
do
not
you shop
like,
online?
Pornhub.
You wear Roberta's clothing. You eat Roberta's food. You're totally insular. I kind of am.
It's kind of. I would say probably the. ESPN and is definitely. I do look at news online as well. Also, probably art kind of things. I'm always from a design point of view. I'm usually looking through the internet for inspiration for
rap,
things.
Music.
I don't actually use the internet.
We call it hip hop now.
Oh, hip-hop, sorry.
We needed Emily here for some good shopping.
Emily is would take up the rest of the show. We're Tony, wait, we have an interview with Tony.
Yeah, I mean, I do think that the, especially when it comes to clothing, the, online, it's just maybe an easier way. Shopping for clothes in a Macy's or whatever, it could be, mind-boggling. You're just there's just so much stuff everywhere.
The last time I was in a Target, I completely freaked out and left.
Right.
It was just too overwhelming.
It's kind of crazy. Shopping for a shirt online seems much easier to me. There's five of them, and you're that's my favorite. You're not like...
Well, you wear everything extra large. You don't care if it fits.
I mean, dropping acid before going to the Target was probably a mistake. Yeah. Nonetheless, it was an overwhelming experience.
Target is overwhelming,
sure.
Yeah.
Right. I only wear Reggie Jackson shirts and then this one Roberta shirt. Wow. And Ann says I dress aspirationally. I dress in mediums. And then they come up to here on me.
You do.
Is that on the spectrum?
Yes, probably.
Aspirationally?
Oh, I see. Uh-huh.
All right. So for the weekly grill, we have Tony Butler has led a life of service, helping to feed the hungry. He just left his post as head of St. John's Bread and Life in Bed-Stuy, Brooklyn, and will be moving with his wife to the countryside of Portugal. He is also a board member of Heritage Radio Network. So welcome.
Oh, thank
Tony.
You.
We're so excited to have you here. So what is the biggest misconception about poverty?
I think the biggest misconception is we think poverty is those people. We have this notion it's either here in New York, it's either people on the train or begging money. In the rest of the country, it's people who don't look like you. And we also have a notion that poor people, I think it's our Calvinist heritage, that poor people are sinners. And so if they're sinners, they deserve to be poor. It's a bad lifestyle choice they made for some reason. That's as opposed to that the economic structures are really stacked against about, well, right now, about 50 million people out of 360 million people. Economic structures are really stacked against them.
Wow.
Well, you know what Tony told me one day is there are all these people that are, you know, they have a job and then all of a sudden they lose their job. They can't find a job for 3, 4, 5 weeks. Yeah. And then guess what? They're standing in line at St. John Bread and Life and they never thought.
We just talked about the New York Times. They did an article about 3 weeks or 4 weeks ago. It takes 20 years of nothing going wrong to get out of poverty in this country.
Wow.
I mean, nobody getting sick, nobody getting laid off, nobody getting arrested, nobody breaking their leg, having an extra baby that you didn't plan on. All those things takes 20 years for a family to get out of poverty.
I used to thought Mike was cheap, but it turns out he's just very close to the poverty line. That's what.
Hand to mouth working for you.
And most
if he didn't spend all his money at the Roberta's bar, he probably would be just fine.
But fortunately, I get
that's
paid,
helping the economy.
I get paid in pork chops by the.
I'm just kidding. That was a joke, Mike. That was a joke.
Interesting. So what do you teach your
bartenders children? Have to go to college, too.
It's true.
So what do you teach your children with regards to giving and charity?
I think that first, giving cannot just be to make you feel good. Mm-hmm. It can't be, here, you poor bastard, here's a dollar, I feel good, you know, I helped you. Yeah. First of all, giving's got to, you have to give out of something that you have, not your extra, your surplus, because it's not making you feel good, but it has to be transformational, because what you have to do is relate to that person you're helping. There has to be a connection. There's a connection of both. Most of us have more, so there's a connection that we have an obligation to use those gifts. A lot of us, myself as a tall white male, I'm an inheritor of a lot of good stuff, a mm-hmm. lot of powerful stuff that I didn't do any, and some of it wasn't actually done very well to get that stuff. But I have an obligation with that privilege to do something, not to use the privilege as kind of, you know, the great white hope, that kind of nonsense. But that, and I teach my children that they've got to give, and they've also got to work on things being transformational, not just transactional.
So let me ask you three. I'll just throw out three numbers. So husband and wife make $75,000 each, so $150,000. What should they give? Is that a fair question?
I mean, imagine, I still ascribe to the kind of biblical of 10%. That's 10% of your net, not your gross. Particularly in this country, I think it's much more important because we do so little charitably with our tax dollars. Mm-hmm. That philanthropy is really, particularly in this town, which is the largest, us in Washington kind of buy off who's the biggest philanthropist. But it's very, very important to give. There's no magic number, but...
So 10% of your net. Wow, that's a big number. Yeah. Much more than anyone does.
Yeah.
I always tell Tony that I feel like kids nowadays, kids, you know, 30-year-olds, 20-year-olds, they support things like on Facebook or by liking an Instagram, but they don't necessarily write a $500 check in December, which is really what they should do if they are wanting to change the world.
I agree with that. I think it's a moral imperative that we help people who are less fortunate than we are. I mean, I know, I'm privileged. I get it. I'm white, middle-class upbringing. I got a lot of opportunities. A lot of people don't. And what Tony was saying before, though, the difference between living on the street and you know, and living in an apartment, it's a very, very fine line.
Yeah.
Things can go south very, very quickly. You lose your job. I mean, even all the years I've lived in New York City, so much of it has been hand-to-mouth that if I were to lose a job, or God forbid, have a medical emergency when I didn't have health care, I mean, a lot of the guys that were living on the street, you found out after the stock market crash in 2008, these were guys that were working on Wall Street days before. But, you know, once they lost their job, they couldn't pay their rent, and they didn't have any safety net. A lot of people don't. A lot of people know I don't have safety nets. You know, they can't move in with mom and dad or have someone write them a check. It's, you know, it's a very iffy existence.
In my previous job, we had a group of Swedish clergy come, and they were shocked at the type of people we had in the food pantry and in the soup kitchen. Working people. They said in Sweden, the people they serve are the really disconnected folks, people with huge drug problems, huge alcohol problems, resistant to any kind of mental health treatment. Those are the folks they saw, not ordinary folks who are just scrambling.
Who have two jobs, but work at McDonald's, maybe.
Or working the minimum wage. Now, it's getting a little better here in New York, but...
Can I ask you a question? What socioeconomic bracket gives the most? You would think it's the richest.
It's the very wealthy and the lower middle class.
Wow.
Those are the two percentage-wise who give the most.
That makes sense, though, because you find like the uber wealthy, Mike Bloomberg's, you know, yeah. Bill and Melissa Gates, and these sorts of people who are incredible. They give away a lot of wealth who are probably affiliated with churches who have good, solid, sound programs and have been brought up to believe, like what we're just talking about, that you should tithe a certain percent, you should give back a certain percent, that there's a moral imperative to do what my people call tzedakah.
But interesting. That's an interesting stat, though, the lower middle. And then, has this generation forgotten what it's like to be hungry?
In the main, probably yes. I mean, there's a whole chunk that, I mean, one in five, it's an interesting question, because one in five New Yorkers and one in six Americans go hungry. So that's a lot of people who haven't forgotten what it's like to be hungry. And children's running about one in four.
The Great Depression and all that. I mean, that generation has passed away. Who remember that?
And and we're such a consumer. We tend to be an obese society, where restaurants are no. I mean, even in our generation, I never went out like this as a child. My parents didn't go out, and we go out. There is food.
Well, you had nine brothers and sisters.
I know. I know. So. But I think we are a privileged nation in the main, and I think we have forgotten, or we see it as such a distant problem. Mm-hmm. You know, every once in a while we see some poor kids trapped in a cave or something. We get heartfelt, but we're sad for those kids trapped in the cave, but we're not terribly sad for the kid around the corner.
Yeah,
I think it's very interesting, like this generation that is forgetting, like when no one is going to be alive. Who witnessed World War II, or no one is alive who witnessed the Great Depression. Yeah. It's going to be, wonder if people...
I just hope that we don't do good stuff and do the right thing only because we've experienced it.
Mm-hmm.
It should be because there's some ethical, moral compulsion or teaching that's why you do it. Because you're right, if it's only experience, then we just jump from the next crisis to the next crisis to the next crisis, which is kind of what we're doing right now. But... And
very wise.
Yeah. All right. And
last question.
This is an exciting question. What's it like making a change, like moving to Portugal at your age, in your 50s?
At my age.
I think 40s. I wanted to write 90s just to joke, and then I wanted to write 30s to joke. But how old are you?
57. Just turned 57.
Wow.
And it's exciting. I mean, it is. I mean, stuff I would have never thought about if I did it in my 30s, like how to get my health insurance, what about any pre-existing illnesses, all that kind of stuff. Living kind of on a fixed income, I mean, not a poor income, but, you know, measuring all that. It's been a year process. It's an incredible kind of weird skill set I just acquired.
I've read that Portugal's like on a very short list of great places to retire in terms of affordability, luxury, and the environment, the ambience.
It's just really lovely.
Expatriated Americans and the culture. You know, it would be great, though, if I knew when I was going to die, I would know exactly how much money I could spend every day.
So wait, have you been to Portugal?
I have a story about that. That's I don't got that.
Like, listen, if I knew, you're gonna say, Mike, you got a week left. I'd say this is great. I could spend $50 a day. You know, but if I'm worried about turning 80 and being broke.
I knew a guy in my church who had cancer, stomach cancer, decided to go to Ireland, and just spend his credit card. Kept spending because he got exactly 6 months a day.
Yeah.
But what happened was
the last check you write should bounce.
All of a sudden, his credit card started getting rejected. He had lived longer than he thought. And he went to the doctor, and his cancer was in remission. Now he's got all these debts on his American Express.
Now he's fucked.
You know, I went to the doctor. He said, look, Mike, you've got 2 weeks. I told him I couldn't pay the bill, so he gave me 2 more weeks.
God, it's Borscht Belt Day here.
Borscht Belt Day.
All right. Well, that was great. Thank you so much, Tony.
You're welcome.
Really shed some light. On
so
some
interesting.
Things.
Tony, we're going to miss
also,
him.
Also, we should add retirement at 57. Congratulations.
If you know Tony, though, he is going to get involved with the little fisherman community. He's going to get involved with the church. He's probably going to be busier there than he was here.
Yeah, I'm not just going to sit around the Portuguese version of The Price is Right or something like that.
He's going to build a garden, and he's going with his lovely wife, Jeannie. Yeah. And he's also going to fly back to New York 2 times to help us with the... help us with the HRM board business. So.
Oh, great.
I thought you meant he was going to come back on the show.
I think we should have the board meeting in Portugal.
So that'd be cool. Give me about 6 months. I'll have a place. We can have it out there, drink good wine, have a board meeting.
I think that's a great idea.
Sure.
That's amazing. All
thanks,
right.
Tony.
So you're thank welcome. You for being here. Thank you, everyone, for listening. And stay tuned for Tech Bites up next. Yeah.
Poppins, you've heard the noise they make, but let me introduce my new Rocket 88. Yes, it's straight, just one way. Everybody likes my Rocket 88. Baby, we'll ride in style.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at @heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.